Hi there, it's old Jim here again with more outrage stuff. Actually, our next two podcasts will be in the while I'm away category. I'm fixing to head off for the Pacific Northwest, British Columbia, for the start of the R2AK. That means the Race to Alaska. It's like the Everglades Challenge in a way, except this one starts at Port Townsend, Washington, goes up to Victoria, BC, and then heads up through the inside passages to Ketchikan, Alaska, 750 miles. My son Russell is competing in his massively refurbished Goujon 32 catamaran, and I want to be there for the send-off at least. I will take my voice recorder and hope to speak with a number of the competitors. Bring it back to you for the podcast sometime in later June. For those of you who might be interested in following the race, they do have a website, R2AK, that is the letter R, the numeral 2, and then letters AK, Race to Alaska. And all the boats have those little transponders on them so that the race organizers are supposed to know where everybody is at all times. Those things have not been too dependable in the Everglades Challenge, but let's hope we can follow along, okay? Anyone who's interested in watching, go to the site and you can see how Russell Brown is doing on the way. This race course is notorious for light airs and strong currents. The winters usually finish in 5 to 7 days, and Russell has what might be called a secret weapon. He and his friend Brandon have developed a very interesting pedal drive, which in pre-race trials has been remarkably efficient. So let's hope it really does a job for him. Of course, his boat is a pretty hot sailboat as is without pedal drive, and many of the boats can either be pedaled or paddled or rowed because the course is so challenging for wind. So, what to bring you while I'm away? Well, I've been speaking with Joe Farinaccio about that, and he suggests that there are a lot of our listeners who are really not aware of the classic early modern marine literature. When I was getting into sailing, books were all we had. There were some great ones, and of course, they're still around. So I'd like to share with you a few of my favorites, and I have some personal stories to go along with them. They help to explain why so many of us old sailors got into seafaring in the first place. Of course, some of you will already know about these stories, but I'm told that many of you have never heard of Joshua Slocum. He was the first man to sail around the world alone, single-handed all the way. And of course, his book is called Sailing Alone Around the World. And I think it is still the book on the subject of single-handing. He was an experienced, consummate mariner, had been the skipper of several commercial vessels right at the end of the age of sail. And when steam started taking over, of course, he was out of a job, but he still wanted to go out there on the big briny. So he found a derelict small boat up in the boatyard someplace, I think, in Massachusetts. I'm doing all of this from memory. It was declining on the hard, but he noticed that it was still serviceable with enough love, so he practically stole the thing and fixed it up, named it Spray, and sailed it around the world. He then wrote a book about his adventures, and the literature is good. He had a very engaging writing style, wonderfully expressive but humble. In fact, it was so good that some have suggested that it was ghost-written. I don't believe that because he did a fair bit of ancillary writing, and he made other voyages. One of the adventures in his book, which still gets passed around in conversation, was his trip through the Straits of Magellan, a trip I've always wanted to make. And there he encountered the Fuegians, or the people, the Indians of Tierra del Fuego. And from previous experience, he knew that some of them had a tendency toward robbery, and they frequently picked on the boats making the passage through the straits. so being alone put him at a distinct disadvantage. He was obliged to anchor for rest in several places, and he knew he was being watched by the natives. So to create the impression that he was not alone, he would pop up out of the forward hatch in some distinctive garb, a distinctive hat, then go back down below and come up out of the main hatch in a completely different outfit. Then show up on deck later and holler to his companions down below. Now the thing about the Fuegians was that even in their extremely cold climate, they went around totally buck naked, including barefoot, no shoes. So as the story goes, before retiring, he scattered thumbtacks about the deck. And sure enough, when he was boarded in the night, he was awakened by the howls of the Indians jumping back into their canoes with thumbtacks in their feet. But for me, the caper I remember most about his story was an incident in one of the Pacific Atoll lagoons. The Spray was anchored out, but he was ashore and required passage from one islet to another, managed to arrange for such passage in a small canoe with the help of a small boy. And as they crossed one of the channels into the lagoon, they were set upon by a strong ebb tide. And it was soon apparent to Slocum that they were going to be swept out at sea in an area where there was nobody around to notice. The boy had the only paddle. Slocum grabbed a pole, and together, by just paddling with the pole and the boy, they were barely able to get across the channel and connect with the islet on the other side. He said he thought it was the closest call that he had during the whole circumnavigation. And the story stayed with me in the form of caution in such situations. Now, I don't want to spoil the story for you, because there are many great yarns in Slocum's writing. And once when we were visiting at Martha's Vineyard with the Newicks, who lived there at the time, we drove past a house that had a big rock in the front yard with a little bronze plaque saying that this had been the residence of one Joshua Slocum for several years while he actually had a family. And because so many have been inspired by his writing, there have been several recreations of Spray, built by individuals for serious ocean cruising, largely because, as explained in Slocum's text, the boat was remarkably stable directionally, that is, it was easy to arrange it for self-steering, long before the day of autopilots. But from what I've heard, only one of those recreations was worth a damn when it came to self-steering, and I think I know why. In fact, I've met the guy that built the boat and took his family on a world cruise under self-steering all the way because, unlike any of the other reproductions, his boat did not have an engine. In fact, I'm rather jaundiced about all of the reconstruction and recreation work going on to preserve nautical history. Every time they build something that's supposed to be a faithful reproduction, of course they put an engine in it. And dragging that propeller is only part of the problem. So why is it that so many replicas of classic boats are poor on course holding and maneuvering? Well, the answer is the propeller aperture. Vessels with long keels that have their rudders attached to the keel require that a big hole be cut between the end of the deadwood and the start of the rudder in order to get the propeller there on center. And that aperture completely destroys the potential for fine steering properties in such a boat. All the trading schooners, right on up through to the square riggers, employed relatively small rudders attached to the aft end of the deadwood, or the extension to the keel. And that rudder really acted as a trim tab. That is, the slightest adjustment to the rudder angle would completely change the pressure gradient over the whole after body of the vessel, so that even the tall ships carrying thousands of tons of cargo could be steered by the strength in human arms. Sometimes they had two or three helm wheels so they could put four, six guys on the helm in a storm, but still These giant machines were guided around the world time and again by the muscles in the helmsman's arms. And that explains in part why the modern fin-keeled yacht with spayed rudder has become so popular. One reason is that, well, first of all, they steer better because the propeller is somewhere else. It's not stuck in an aperture between the deadwood and the rudder. So it was Joshua Slocum who was the first to try to teach us that. And multi-hulls, of course, those with inboard engines with no keel at all, or maybe just a mini keel, do not require an aperture. The propellers are out in open water space. They can be much more efficient, and yet their propeller blast is directed right at the rudder, which is either of the spade type or transom hung, so that under power they have excellent maneuverability, especially in catamarans with twin engines, very often of the sail drive type, and with folding or feathering propellers so as to disturb the sailing properties of the vessel as little as possible with the auxiliary engine. And of course, many of the smaller multi-hulls are equipped with outboard motors, which can be completely retracted when under sail. Very well, let's go on to another author. How about Irving Johnson? Now there was a consummate seaman, and so was his wife, Electra, and so was his mate, Sterling Hayden. Right, the grade B movie actor Sterling Hayden is also a skilled and experienced mariner. I have a story about him later. But Irving Johnson cut his teeth in the big steel square riggers. Right up into the 1930s, these giant vessels were still used commercially for hauling grain between Australia and Europe. And Irving Johnson developed himself into a bull of a man sailing in these ships. He had such strength and such gymnastic ability that he could shinny up a telephone pole, perch himself on its very top, and do a headstand. So when he went to sea, of course, he was valued for his work aloft. He was also an early avid cinematographer, and he once made a passage in the great ship Peking, which incidentally is now the principal floating exhibit at the South Street Seaport Museum in New York City, where one can visit aboard and enjoy seeing Irving Johnson's films shown in the forepeak of the ship on which they were made. And believe me, there is some riveting footage. Some is taken from high in the rigging, looking down on the vessel as she is running in huge seas rounding Cape Horn. The ship is so big, and the waves she is sailing in are so great, that when the vessel is perched on a crest, the seas board the vessel amidships from both sides, just inundating the deck amidships. Which is why, in the last of the German ships particularly, there were catwalks leading from one deckhouse to another so that the crew could pass over the deck, avoid being washed overboard by the seas. Now, climbing around in the rigging in such conditions with a movie camera, well, that was one thing, but at one point, Johnson passes the camera to a companion who is in the crew and also hanging on to one of the yards way up a couple of hundred feet above the deck, and the companion films Johnson performing an amazing physical feat. He goes out to the end of the yard, squirms down to grasp the edge of the sail, the course, the tabling or the hem in the edge of the square sail. He grabs the canvas with his hands, swings his feet down, pitches the sail between his feet and slithers down the edge of the sail, sliding it through his hands and feet from one yard to another while the vessel is romping in the roaring 40s around Cape Horn. And as Johnson narrates in the film, that footage was later shown to the captain of another square rigger who said, "That was not done." Well, I'm sure you can find that footage somewhere on the net, and yet, believe me, there's nothing like seeing it in the forepeak of the Peking as she lies afloat there in the East River at South Street, Manhattan. That's my town. Yeah, I'm a New Yorker. Anyway, Johnson and his wife, Electra, later had the 90-foot North Sea pilot vessel. Oh my gosh, I cannot remember her name. Anyway, they sailed it around the world several times, I think, with charter parties aboard and Sterling Hayden and the crew. They would leave their home port in Connecticut, New London, I think, and Johnson would proclaim, "We will be back on such and such a date in such a year." And he would come in on the dot at noon with the vessel looking better than when she headed out. Now, I never had the privilege of meeting the Johnsons, but we did know Hayden briefly when we lived in Sausalito. And Hayden had the San Francisco bar pilot schooner named Wanderer. That's what he named her. Her original name was the Gracie S., Gracie Spreckles, for the Spreckles Sugar Empire. And we were acquainted with Hayden's mate, a young Irishman named Peter Campbell. And we were all living on a houseboat up there at Gate 5, Sausalito. And our firstborn son, Stephen, was an infant at the time, coming upon his first birthday. So Campbell invited us to come aboard the Wanderer for a little birthday party. Of course, I told him of my schooner experience with Captain Mike Burke in the Caribbean. Hayden said that schoonering with passengers was done by many lesser men than Irving Johnson. And he was right. Now, I once saw Johnson's ship. Gosh, what was her name? Yankee. There, yes, the 90-foot North Sea steel pilot schooner. Oh, actually, I think she was a brigantine. Right, she carried square sails on the foremast. She was lying afloat at New London, Connecticut, and I happened to be there because of my high school friends, the Chester brothers. Their father was a honcho in the Navy, and he managed to secure for them a lifeboat and the information on how to rig it as a sailing catch. And these guys, the Chester brothers, Conrad and Scott, fixed that thing up so that it was a bona fide sailboat, man. And we had a lot of fun with that thing on Long Island Sound, sailing out of Manhasset Harbor. And it was early July, one hot summer, and we were on the way to Connecticut to buy fireworks where they were legal. You couldn't buy them in New York. So we'd go over there and tub up on fireworks and bring them back and sell them and blast the daylights out of all our neighbors. But that was one of my first sailing experiences. Boy, and I was really quite taken with what a wonderful way it was to get around and be free of such things as laws against fireworks. Now, of course, the Johnsons wrote books and many articles in publications like National Geographic about their sailings. And I recommend their writings as grounding in the very notion of seafaring. Of course, this heritage of modern seafaring literature is huge. Some that have stayed with me are little known, like The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss and his other book, Tillicum, great adventure stories. And of course, there's nothing like Tristan Jones. His adventure stories are so off the wall that they are officially in the fiction class. I think if he had more pictures of his feats that he would be believed. But there is a picture of his hauling his boat up to Lake Titicaca in South America, the highest lake where you can sail. But I think my favorite is called Ice. It's when he purposely went up into the Arctic and got stuck in the ice to spend the winter. One of those yarns is that when his vessel was stuck in the ice and he was approached by a polar bear who was obviously hungry, Tristan managed to get out his flare pistol, and just as the bear was roaring into his face, he fired a flare right down the gullet of this polar bear, who jumped out onto the ice, hopped down on his forepaws like a puppy playing, and went, huh, huh, trying to huff out the flare, and retreated quietly. I once met Tristan Jones, too, and we had a great talk. I complimented him on how much pleasure he had brought to so many readers, and he said, "You, sir, have good taste." And incidentally, one of his boats was a trimaran, and he wrote about its ability to just slash through the seas. He was a great fan of his cool tubes. He had big lengths of plastic pipe strapped up underneath the bottom of his boat, and the weight of the water in those tubes apparently tended to stabilize the motion of the vessel and, of course, help prevent capsize. But I don't know of any other designer sailor who has tried them. Seems they might be worthy of investigation. Tristan was great about introducing young people to serious sailing. I guess he's gone now. He got sick. He had to have his leg amputated. Still went sailing, but I think whatever it was, diabetes or something, finally got him. And now that I think of it, well, all of these folks I've been speaking of are long gone. Well, I don't know about Hayden, but Joshua Slocum kept on sailing until he disappeared at sea. His last voyage, he took Spray out when she was in very rickety condition. I can't help but suspect that he was intending to fade away at sea that way. I feel sure that Irving and Electra Johnson are gone now. And of course, so are the great Eric and Susan Hiscock. I'll be pleased to speak of them in the best of terms next time we meet and follow up with my own personal sea story. Okay, bye-bye.